Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Oh, look at the sun. Look at the sunlight. Isn't it nice on a January day to see the sun come out? The ground is just really well fed with water right now. That's all right. Things are growing well. Everything that has been just poking along, it's responding to these longer days. It's responding to the sunlight. Things are growing really well. And I know that you must have dozens of different things growing in your garden right now. You should have the whole gamut. You should be harvesting broccoli and kale and collards and turnips and radishes and parsley and cilantro. Just the list goes on and on. Lettuce. You should be Chinese cabbages, American cabbages. This should be the most productive time of the year in your garden. Of course you're not. Of course it's not. You know, I think that we would say, you know, you've got a garden like you ain't from around here. And that's how we all do. We garden like we ain't from around here. It's like we haven't really figured out where we are. You hear this from me all the time. We really haven't figured out the potential. January is one of the great times to be gardening in Mobile. It's one of the great times for gardening in South Alabama. It's easy to do. There are tons of plants out there that could be growing right now, and everything would be really, really easy. You'd be having a great time. We could talk about all the things. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, we still haven't figured out where we are. And that may be the fact, maybe the result of the fact that we ain't been around here very long. You think, oh, well, I'm from Alabama. My family's from Alabama. Well, not for very long. Not for very long at all. None of us really have a memory for this place that's very old. Even if we listened to our grandparents and our great-grandparents, our memory of this landscape and of this place and of what gardening is like here is maybe at best a couple hundred years old, maybe. But, you know, here's that ain't very long. That ain't very long. You know, there have been people gardening in this part of the world. There were people gardening here 15,000 years ago. And that's important to think about, you know, and it's not, we think about, well, what was it like for the Native Americans? And we think about, oh, well, here were the three sisters. We know how Native Americans gardened, right? They had corn and squash and beans. And those were the three sisters, and that's how they gardened, and that's what they lived on. Well, if that's what they gardened and lived on, and it may have been dominant for a while, that was fairly recent too. That was only a few hundred years, really, out of the great long history of gardening and farming and growing things to keep people alive in North America, because that goes back thousands of years, 15,000 years. We have evidence of gardens dating back 8,000, 9,000, 10,000 years of cultivation of plants in one way or another in North America. So how do we learn from that? You know, what was it like? So I told you on New Year's, I was kind of thinking about what was it like to have a garden in Alabama when you had to keep the mastodons out of the garden? What was it like? Have you ever thought about that? When people first came here, we talked about that last week. We talked about some of the many creatures. And it really is beginning to impress me. I think a lot of our existence was based on those creatures. We wiped those creatures out. When we first came to Alabama, when we first came to North America, we wiped so much of that out. It was a Serengeti. It would have been like gardening now in the middle of Africa. people would have had gardens, people would have had cultivated crops, but they also would have followed along behind the animals, and the animals themselves would have created opportunities for certain plants that, that we don't have now. One of those plants might have been squash. Mastodons and mammoths probably were very good at eating the earliest types of squash. And they spread that squash around a pretty good bit. We've lost the wild squashes, but they were eventually domesticated, probably about the time that we began to wipe out the mammoths and the mastodons in Alabama. We decided, you know, we better find something else to eat. What are we going to do? So we had gardens. We began creating gardens in big ways that, about that time. Really more deliberate cultivation of things. And there's a lot to learn from that. Squash, of the three sisters that we talk about now, corn, beans, and squash, squash was probably was the most important. And it wasn't the squash that we, it was a relative of the squash. It was the ancestor of the squash we eat now. But interestingly enough, and this is one of the things we've really forgotten about squash and its relatives, like pumpkins and winter squash and summer squash, the most nutritious part of the squash is the seed, not the meat. And we forget that. And so squash were probably first domesticated both for the shape of the plant, which made a real good carrying vessel, and a container to mix stuff in. That would have been pretty nice. But also for the seeds. Squash, one of the early crops. Lots of other things that we don't think about. Things like sumpweed, which was hugely important. Iva. Let's use the name Iva because it sounds prettier to you. Iva frutescens, Iva annua. These are things that grow in the marshes now. They have really large seeds. They're really important wildlife food, but they were an important part of a human agricultural complex for a long time. This little thing, and plants I'm discovering now that I've really ignored all my life. I hadn't really thought about them, but these were important Indian foods and ancestral foods of North America. And big civilizations, big communities were built on these foods. Things like little barley, this grass, it kind of is like a foxtail grass, but not quite a foxtail grass. It looks like a barley, looks like a little miniature barley, really important to a lot of cultures. Little barley was out there. Phalaris, this thing called canary, thing called reed grass, which is very important, and I found some the other day. It's just this really, and it occurred to me, gosh, what big seeds. You could really make use of this if you were really good. There's in South America, what's become very popular is this thing, grain called quinoa. Oh, man, don't try to spell it, and don't try to pronounce it if you see the word, Q-U-I-N-O-A. Let's call it quinoa. Quinoa has been really, really important it was really, really important in South America, but North America had its own version of quinoa. It was really important, a type of Cynopodium. We don't even have a name for it anymore. It's kind of like lamb's quarters. And, you know, I still think we're seeing traces of it around the old shell mounds around Mobile Bay. What I'm thinking about all these wonderful plants, and what is really interesting to me is how diverse that early agriculture was and what we could learn from it. And the fact that these people looked around them and had been thinking about it for a long, long time. They're not like us newcomers. They're not like us folks who haven't really figured out where we are yet. They looked around that landscape, and they began using it in really, really remarkable ways and domesticating things that you could never have imagined. Corn came late. Ooh, I had some beautiful corn last night. I should tell you about it. I should tell you about how to make it. Corn was a really incredible find, but it was an invented plant. We'll talk. Maybe we can have some time to talk about that. But there were a lot of other plants that people were using. that I think we can still learn from. We'll talk about that when we come back, and we'll talk about your garden. We'll talk about how to figure out where you are and finally make use of it. Make use of January. We'll be back.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Things that are really good for us here along the Gulf Coast. So we've been talking a little bit about life here on the Gulf Coast, and what it's like, and what it was like 15,000 years ago here along the Gulf Coast, and because there were people who had tons of experience with gardening that we could have learned from, we could still learn from them. We're still finding little pieces out about what that was like. So we've been talking about that this morning. I keep finding traces of this old gardening. You know, last night we had something really delicious, and it's a part of gardening that we've completely forgotten. It's not the oldest form of gardening in North. It wasn't from the oldest form of gardening in North America. In fact, it was a really newcomer. It was a newcomer. It was the newfangled thing. It was corn. Corn was a kind of a newfangled crop for much of North America. And here's why. It didn't even grow wild. We're not entirely sure where corn came from. Did something like corn ever grow wild? It could have been a strange hybrid between something we now call teosinte from Mexico and Arizona and Texas, may have even gotten as far as Alabama at one point, back in the days when the shoreline of Alabama was 80 miles south of where it is now, when Dolphin Island was just a big line of hills when people first came to Alabama. And Dolphin Island wasn't an island at all, but just a big line of hills where you looked 80 miles south. And if you could see far enough from Dolphin Island, you could maybe see the shoreline. I doubt you could see that far, because that would be like, man, that's like Dolphin Island was so far inland, it would be like where Troy and Greenville are now. That's an amazing thing, isn't it? That's what Alabama was like, much bigger place when people first came here. But what teosinte and another plant that we call gamma grass, which is actually quite used to be and fairly, and it's still somewhat common in South Alabama. Boy, there's some growing in my neighborhood in Midtown. Oddly enough, I've always tried to figure out over by the cemetery, nice little crop of gamma grass. I've seen whole fields of gamma grass. It's one of the really great pastures, grasses, ever. Boy, do animals love it. They eat it. It's really incredibly nutritious, really a wonderful thing. And maybe those two got together and created this thing called corn. But that was really pretty late. And then it took people a long time to really develop a corn cob that was significant enough. And then they had to develop the agriculture. And then at some point, they finally got it to where they wanted it, and they became corn addicted. and we got the great Mississippian culture, which basically choked itself to death from its dependence on corn and a few other grains until it collapsed even before Columbus got here. Corn's a big deal, and corn's a cool thing. Last night we had something that I will call pozole, which is hominy, which is what grits are really made from, except that we don't even remember what grits are like in the South anymore. We don't remember the original hominy. We don't remember the original grits. Hominy was made, nixtamalized. It was made from a process that was very old. You took your corn husk, you took your corn, pulled it off the husk. It had a lot of problems, corn did, when it was raw. One of the first problems was is that a lot of the nutrients in the corn aren't available when it's just good old raw corn. And if you ate nothing but corn, you'd get a disease that we now call pellagra. You probably don't remember what pellagra is because we now add things like niacin to our food, to our breads and other things to keep from getting pellagra. But if you ate just pure corn and you ate a lot of pure corn, you'd get this disease called pellagra, which causes all kind of problems. It causes severe stomach upsets. It causes severe dementia. It creates other problems. Your muscles begin to collapse. You get sores all over your body because your skin becomes hypersensitive to sun, and eventually you die from pellagra. And pellagra comes from eating too much corn that basically has just been ground up. So early on, people figured, you know, I don't know how they figured this out. People will ask me. I don't know. I wasn't there. But here's what happened. They realized that if you took those corn seeds, if you took the kernels, and if you put them in a pot with lime, with ashes from your fire, and there was plenty of that, and you could imagine it happen accidentally. Oops, somebody dropped some ashes into the pot of corn that was there boiling, the corn gruel that was boiling. And what they found was that when that happened, the skins slipped from the kernel. You could easily rub the skins off the kernel, and it transformed the nutrients in that kernel so that niacin was available. You no longer had pellagra. The kernel was this nice puffy thing, big old grain, much larger than the kernel that you would normally eat. It was much easier, and you could use it in lots of ways. You could dry it and then grind it for cornmeal, and it had all of the nutrients that the raw corn didn't have. This is something we forgot. It's something Mexico didn't forget. So if you want that smell, that wonderful smell of what corn was really like to most North American cultures, you go to a Mexican restaurant. And if they're doing it right, there's a peculiar smell. It's an interesting smell that I only associate. In fact, when I'm going down the street on my bicycle, if I'm passing by a Mexican restaurant, I don't even know. I know there's a Mexican restaurant nearby. I don't even have to see it, but I know there's an authentic Mexican restaurant nearby because it's that particular smell. It's a really nice smell. It's a very interesting smell. It's the smell of nixtamalization. It's the smell of dropping your corn kernel into that pot of lye, into that pot of wood ashes. And that's how we make tamale. It's how we make all of the corns we make. It's how tacos are made. It's how traditional Mexican breads are made. It's why they're so different. And it's how grits were originally made in the South. Our original grits were not what we grow now, just a sort of a corn gruel that's been ground up. They were nixtamalized. They had a particular taste and a particular odor and a particular smell, and it was really, really robust, really wonderful thing. I had traditional hominy that had been dried, soaked it for a long time to get it to puff up again. Cooked it into a stew last night. It was absolutely wonderful and delicious. Corn is a great thing. We've really forgotten even how to use corn, and corn is the newcomer. But boy, there were lots of other things, lots of other cool, cool plants out there that people were using, and it's time we began thinking about how they used them. And here's why. I'm just going to tell you why. Because when people first began developing these things, when they first began developing squash, squash was this wild thing that the meat was inedible. It was so bitter you couldn't have eaten it. But early on, very quickly after, they began wiping out the mastodons and the mammoth and the buffalo and the wild llamas and the horses and the reindeer and the elk and all of these other creatures that they had depended on for food. Three species of buffalo, can you imagine? That's what people found in Alabama when they came here. Can you imagine having camel-like things grazing all over Alabama? That's what it was like. It was an amazing thing. But they had wiped them out. And suddenly, things were in transition. The climate was changing. They may have had something big to do. People may have had something big to do with that climate change even in those days. But the climate was changing rapidly. It was warming. Things were becoming different. They had to do something. Things were changing. And what they did was they began looking around them at these wild plants, and they began domesticating them. It's how we got squash. It's how little barley became so important. It's how we got quinoa and the North American version of quinoa. We're going to have to start discovering all these plants again. That's kind of what I'm thinking about as this new year changes. Discovering where we are, discovering how to take advantage of it. Maybe we'll talk a little bit more about it as the morning goes on, but feel free to give us a call. 251-343-0106.
I was raised in the country, that's a natural fact. Food on the table from the garden out back. Everyone working to make the land their own. Red clay cracking where the silver queen grows. Running with your cousins from yard to yard. The living was easy, but the playing was hard. Didn't have much, nothing comes for free. All you needed was your family. I am a country girl. I've been around the world. And every place I've been. Ain't quite nothing like living in the South. Oh, wanna shut your mouth. I am a country girl. I am a country girl.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. It's the Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. You're giving me plenty of time to think about what I've been thinking about for a couple of weeks now. Well, actually longer than that, but really intensely since New Year's Day. I've been really, really thinking about it. If we weren't such newcomers, if we weren't such, all of us, if we weren't all such carpetbaggers, we're all carpetbaggers. Don't give me that yakety yak about somebody coming in after the Civil War. We're all carpetbaggers. We're all new. We've just barely gotten here. We still don't know where we are. We're still trying to figure it out. So I keep thinking about these gardens, and what if we had been here for a while, if we had been here 15,000 years, if we had a memory for being here 15,000 years, which is exactly probably within a couple of millennia about how long people have been on this continent, maybe 17,000 years, maybe 20,000 years, something like that. People have been on this continent. And they've been gardening for a long time. And what we talk about with gardening, what we know about gardening, really is only about what gardening has been like over the past 50 years. And really, even over the past 50 years, it's not about gardening in Alabama. It's about what we know about gardening is about how people garden in Indiana. You move to Fort Wayne, you'd do all right. You'd have an okay garden. You wouldn't have to think about gardening in January because you don't do much gardening in January, and it's hard in Fort Wayne, Indiana. It's too far north. But, man, what a great time to garden here along the Gulf Coast, something I keep emphasizing. David Hubble says he's got his seeds in the peat pods. This is the time, folks. I should tell you, how many of you will take advantage of this? I hope you're paying attention. I hope you're listening now. But this is the time to start your tomato seeds. Sorry. That's the way it is here. That's the way life is on the Gulf Coast. You know, we freeze vegetables on the Gulf Coast like we live in Fort Wayne. Because there's going to be this long winter when we don't have, there's no time when you don't have fresh food coming out of your garden on the Gulf Coast. No time. It's just a matter of planning. You'll have plenty of it. And now is the time to start your peppers. It's now the time to start your tomatoes. It's just that time. You can't delay with the tomatoes. You can't delay with a lot of the sweet peppers. You can't delay. And these are just the things we know how to grow. There's so many wonderful things that we've lost. We've lost entirely. And I'm thinking about those things. I'm thinking about what they were. What were these gardens like? And one of the things I can tell you, here's one thing I'm discovering about the old gardens that I think you really have to turn your head upside down to get at, but it is one of the most important things we can learn from gardening in North America, ancient gardening in North America. For 15,000 years or more, successful gardens were planted in North America without a plow. Without a cultivator, without what do you call those things? Tillers. They were cultivated for 15,000 years, and nobody barely even turned the earth. What is going on? How did we miss this? How did we lose this sense of how that worked? Man, they didn't have commercial fertilizers. It's interesting, isn't it? You know, it's very, very, I always think, you know, I'm trying to tell you something new by telling you, don't use a tiller. You're going to destroy your garden. Don't turn your topsoil upside down. Topsoil is on the top. It's there for a reason. I tell you this all the time, and I think, well, I'm not telling you anything new. That's the way it was done for 15,000 years in North America. We're the ones who changed that. And we changed it fairly recently. And we messed up when we did. And you really mess up on the Gulf Coast if you do that. You know, there's another interesting thing. It's not just the fact. It's not just how the ground was not prepared in the way we do it now. Because when they prepared it the way they did, they didn't end up with a soil compaction. They didn't end up with... In fact, they probably had fewer problems with weeds, and I could explain that later by not exposing that soil. They certainly didn't lose their organic matter. They probably preserved their nitrogen better, and they probably made potassium and phosphorus more available by using the native soil creatures to make those things available, which you could only do if you don't use a plow. But all these things were really, really, really useful. But here's another interesting thing I've learned beyond how they prepared the ground is that originally that culture mixed plants together. There weren't rows and rows and rows of corn, at least until much later, maybe not ever. There weren't rows and rows and rows of squash all neatly laid out. There weren't rows of tomatoes. They had tomatoes. It was all mixed together. That is part of traditional agriculture. Even the Mississippian culture seems to have mixed those crops together, and they were the probably the most destructive of all the agriculturalists, the ones who choked on their own refuse, just like we're about to do. That Mississippian culture, even they mix crops. But if you look at the original, if you look at the original people, the people who have been gardening for 15,000 years, one of the really interesting things is how many crops they mix together in one place. So somebody was doing, I think it was an experiment with little barley, this great wild plant. It's still out there. I've ignored it too long. I'm not going to ignore it anymore. It's really great for wildlife. It's really great. The quail love it. It's one of these crops we've, it's one of these plants we've lost, and in the process we lost the things that we really loved, like quail and grassland birds, and turkey love it. It's a beautiful thing called little barley. Little barley was only sort of productive if you grew it by yourself. But a recent researcher trying to reconstruct how people gardened before corn, before the Mississippian culture, before people from Europe came, how did people garden here? She decided to mix a couple of crops together, smartweed and little barley. And when she mixed those two together, both of them fairly common plants now, when she mixed them together, the productivity grew by leaps and bounds when the crops were mixed together. Now, isn't that something? We think it's more productive to grow a plant by itself. That's only that it's only more productive when you're trying to pick it with a combine. So we've let machinery dictate how we grow our gardens. Even the machinery we don't use dictates how we think about growing gardens. But in the old days, and still in many traditional gardens in Mexico and other places, they mix these crops together. One of the interesting things is I remember when the first, when some of the first Vietnamese and Cambodian people came to Mobile, and I remember their gardens, and I was fascinated by them. And I think they've probably lost a lot of their memory of how to build gardens. Those families, and it's too bad because they've become part of American culture. But they, I'm so privileged to have seen it, because what they did, they didn't garden in straight lines like we do. They didn't lay out a bunch of rows and till them up and plow them. They didn't do any of those things. They built a big circle. Just a big circle, and they threw stuff into it, just everything. They threw the refuse, they threw paper, they threw branches, they threw shrimp shells, tons and tons and tons of shrimp shells. They had plenty of them, bones, and then they'd burn it, and then they'd planted it. There were a lot of advantages to doing it that way, and they had learned, having been gardening, their cultures, bringing that knowledge of gardening over thousands of years from one tropical area to another, and understanding this is what you have to do to make it work. And their gardens were mixtures. They weren't, it wasn't a bunch of discrete little plants. It wasn't just, oh, let's plant our corn here. Let's plant our eggplants here. Let's plant our tomatoes here. They were all mixed in very interesting ways. It's an interesting thing to learn. Interesting thing to, we're learning from these cultures. So I'm playing with this. You know, I am planting this year. I always have been using lamb's quarters for a long time. My favorite green. I probably haven't convinced you to use it yet, but lamb's quarters are the. You will never grow a better collard. You will never grow any green better than lamb's ears. They're absolutely delicious. Absolutely lamb's quarters, excuse me, absolutely delicious greens. But I'm also now growing groundnut, one of the traditional crops of North America, a really important crop, sort of the North American potato. We'll talk about that when we come back. Unless, of course, you give me a call. 251-343-0106.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. It's the Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening and a beautiful Sunday morning in January, where I hope, boy, you're taking advantage of your garden. I hope you have lots of things coming out of your garden today. Because, boy, it's going to start growing because the days are getting longer. And if it's been in the ground any length of time, even if you messed up, Dan, even if you messed up and planted late this fall, it's really going to start turning around now. You're going to get a lot of things growing very quickly. The weather's going to be incredibly warm through the end of January. I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it is a thing. It's just going to be warm. We're going to get plenty of rain, maybe too much rain. The old Tom Bigby, it's swelling. Be interesting to watch the Tom Bigby this year with all this rain. You just watch it. Watch what happens over the next couple of weeks. It's going to be a big deal. But I keep thinking, the start of this new year, we've been talking a lot about it, and I'm enjoying these thoughts. And thinking about what gardening was like. What can I learn from 15,000 years of gardening in Alabama? And it's interesting. You know, even corn, when you begin thinking about how long gardening has been going on in Alabama, even corn is a newcomer. It's interesting to kind of think about what the earliest crops were that were really big. Interestingly enough, peanuts and cotton. Some form of peanut, maybe not the peanut we use now, but groundnuts, probably some form of groundnut, cotton. These are 10,000-year-old plants here in North America. We have evidence for them dating back, and in South America, dating back 10,000 years. Squash was one of the earliest domesticates, as a scientist like to say, one of the earliest plants that were domesticated. And they were domesticated for a very particular reason, and it's something we've forgotten about with squashes. They were grown because you could make pretty good vessels out of them to hold things. That was important because they had tough skins in the old days. In fact, there's a squash that we grow now called Seminole pumpkin, and you can get a sense of that tough skin. We eat squash for that pulpy, soft meat. But in general, squashes were first grown for the seeds, which are highly nutritious, and seeds are something we forget about. In fact, the meat of those early squashes was so rich with cucurbitans, with these particular little toxic chemicals that we still find in cucurbits. It's one of the reasons why if you eat the wrong cucumber, you get terrible gas, excuse me for saying. But they were so bitter and so strong that you couldn't eat the pulp, but you could eat the seeds. And they developed those early squash varieties to produce seeds, and those seeds were really important to their diet. You know, in my mind, I have this idea of what a very early garden along the Gulf Coast might have looked like, because I've seen remnants of it, and I'm going to tell you about it in the next hour when we get a chance. I'm going to tell you about the earliest remnants of gardens that I've discovered along the Gulf Coast and what they look like and what it tells me about what they grew there and how they grew it. It's very instructive. We're going to be back, and I'm going to tell you where those places are. But Bruce, I'm listening. What's up? You there?
I'm sorry?
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes. I was reading a magazine article about natural insect control, and they said the best way to do it was to plant a bunch of flowers and other plants that were beneficial to the other insects to attract to the garden to prey on the insects that attack the vegetables. Does that sound logical?
It does in many, many ways, and it works really well. Let me, it's very interesting, but it depends on which pests. One of the things I'm always careful to do when I plant a garden is to have lots and lots of small flowered plants that are blooming around that garden. Not things like daylilies, not with the big open flowers, but lots of little small flowers. Sunflowers would be a classic case with a plant with many small flowers. It seems to have one big flower, but if you look in the center of that big flower, and sunflowers, by the way, were one of the earliest crops in North America. If you look in the center, there are lots of little flowers, and each of those little flowers produces a seed. That's why there's so many seeds in a sunflower. So there are lots of things. Mints produce lots of really small flowers like that, and pycnanthemums and lots of things. These tend to attract a lot of different predatory insects, including things like wasp. And wasp, you know, we see a wasp and we think, oh, I got to get out the insecticide. But the wasp in a garden is one of the best friends you could ever have. The wasp will carry off caterpillars in huge numbers, and they can make a big difference. They really are good predators in the garden. So yes, absolutely. Having lots of small flowered plants around your garden is a great way to encourage predatory insects like wasp and lots of others, all different kinds of sizes of wasps, some so small you don't even notice them, some big enough that you worry about them, but they're not going to bother you in the garden. All of those things can work really, really well to control pests. It doesn't work on everything, and I'll be honest. For example, stink bugs. I think that we've created a paradise for stink bugs, and we keep introducing more of them. And you're not going to have enough natural predators to really... They do play some role in controlling the stink bugs, but not enough. So sometimes you have to go beyond just having the natural predators out there. But having natural predators, you have no idea how important it is. Those natural predators are controlling things like aphids. They're controlling things like caterpillars. Lots of soft-bodied insects are very, very vulnerable to those insect predators. So, yeah, makes a big difference.
Yeah, I have a problem with aphids. And I don't know, it's got the kind that has the ants that tend them.
Yep.
And so you get a lot of aphids, and then when you pick, you get stung by ants. And I tried spraying with the hose, but it just didn't work. I mean, they come right back.
Yeah, we're going to have to go to break, and which is too bad because this is a great, great time to talk about it. Bruce, can you hold on till I come back from break? And let me talk a little bit about aphids and how to deal with them and the ants. I remember your calling, and we talked a little bit about it. We'll be back after this break and talk a little bit more about that.
I declare I ain't gonna pick no peas. Because everything is on the phone, you know you got.